develop, and it is going to require a major change in pedagogy, as Common Core has done. At the state level, what's kind of interesting is that they've rolled this out in three phases, but the phases kind of overlap. So 2013 to 16, so we're in the middle of that, is supposed to be the awareness phase. So we're in the awareness phase with NGSS. But then 2015 to 2018, so there's a little overlap there, is the transition phase. That's when we should be transitioning to these new standards. 2016 and beyond, again, another overlap, is the implementation phase. So what have we done as a district? We've had a committee meeting all year made up of teachers and administrators at all levels, elementary, middle school, and high school. We focus most of our energy on the middle school and high school. The awareness phase has been a big part of elementary school, but we are creating new scope and sequence of our science classes at the middle school level. As this board knows, we are creating a new A through G aligned NGSS integrated science class at the ninth grade level. And then we'll begin moving into other high school classes, biology, chemistry, physics, integrating the NGSS standards into those. So our future will probably be trickling up and then trickling down, but we are staying away from implementation at the elementary level next year. It's just a lot on elementary teachers' plates, and so we're still working on kind of awareness. We're not having expectations of changing science at this point, because it will require a lot of training. To do these standards justice, it's going to take a major commitment on our part, and we just need to figure out how to do that. We probably will not be tested on these standards till 2017, maybe 16, maybe 18, we never know, but probably 2017, and we don't know at what grade levels we'll be tested. We haven't received that yet, but we're kind of working on that projection that 2017 will be the first time that we actually have some accountability in terms of assessments. So that's just a little bit about science, because we haven't spent a lot of time talking about it at the board level. I do want to mention that another topic is that we are finishing up our LCAP outreach, going out to sites and meeting with different people and getting input on our local control accountability plan. I had the pleasure of attending the DLAC meeting last Thursday night, the District English Language Advisory Committee, and always inspiring to be with that group of parents and paraeducators, teachers, and just getting that input. Three real highlights came out of that group, and that's one of the groups that were required by law to get input from on the LCAP. First, the board should know it's super appreciative of the efforts we did last year on busing and increasing busing, on after-school programs and busing for after-school programs, and for summer school and busing to summer school. All three of those things were super important to that group and very appreciative of it, so we'll probably want to continue that. I heard a lot about extracurricular activities, and it was an interesting conversation because it wasn't so much it wasn't necessarily things that the school district controls or has purview over, but parents were very concerned, especially at that middle school level, of their children having equal access and opportunities to participate in sports and clubs and programs, and we're seeking assistance from the district in that. And part of it was economic access, part of it was just knowing, and so something that we can think about. And the other thing that the parents were concerned about was post-high school issues. How are students navigating getting to Cuesta, getting to, college, and any assistance we can give in that, which is something we obviously need to pay attention to. But great group, good input, and we'll incorporate those ideas into our plan. And that's what I got.
Anyone from the public wanting to address any of this? Any comments, questions from the board? All right, Measure D update, Mr. Pinkerton.
Yes, I'm going to have Rick Stimson come up right now. He comes bearing gifts for the board. As you know, we're in the midst right now working with both high schools, both San Luis Obispo High School and Morro Bay High School, and in terms of getting our plans together and construction, and tonight we're going to be asked to begin the construction of the Morro Bay High School pool project. And so if you're going to be on site and there's a construction project, you're going to need a couple of things. You're going to need a hard hat, you're going to need a vest. And so Rick has been great.
Closed-toed shoes.
Yes, closed-toed shoes. So though we don't want you to go to the construction sites by yourself, we do want you to have the gear, right, to be able to attend those. So we wanted to hand these out again because we know over the next 7 years you're going to be visiting a lot of construction sites. And so these will be good things to have in your car so you are prepared as we begin our phase.
Some people
need more than others. Yes. So Rick's been great putting this all together, you know, in terms of you know, getting everything for our employees as well as for all of us here today. So Rick, thank you. Thank you.
When do we get to wear them next?
Soon. Morro Bay High School pool. Mr. Buckman.
Just a quick question. When you said that Rick had something for us, Rick is our great plumbing guy, right?
Yes, he is.
So I really
He's a multitasker.
Okay, good, because I was expecting really something else. But
yes, no, but this is
thanks,
good.
Thanks, Rick.
So we'll have to take a nice photo with our hard hats and our
Thank
vests
you
here.
Very much.
Mr. Quisberry.
Well, I just wanted to mention that Walter was ever the optimist, thought maybe it was some goggles and Speedos and a kickboard.
Oh, sorry.
So
a nice towel, Measure D towel.
No.
Just hard hats and vests. So on a different note, we have our, Ellen's ready. She's ready to go. We have our board study session on a serious note this Friday. And so, yeah, you don't need to wear the hard hat and the vest this Friday, but we will be going through the design process with the board in terms of the committee, the makeup, how the design process works, agency approvals. We'll be looking at classroom standards, as well as discussing with the board kind of ways for the board to give input and review and kind of the board's role part of it. So we'll be talking about that and kind of the board's expectation as we move forward. Had two great meetings today with PMSM and Leslie O'Connor at Slow High, Anthony and myself, just as a check-in. Where they're at, because they've been working with their site committee just to kind of check in where we at, what's going on. Did the same thing at Morro Bay High School today with Kyle Pruitt and KBZ Architects, Anthony and myself, again, check in. And so they've done a lot of work. They're both going to be there on Friday to kind of share where they're at in the process so far and what's how the committee's working and those types of things. So I think it'll be a great study session for the board with a lot of great information. Okay.
Well, as usual, I'll be looking forward to the study session. They are really helpful. All right. Anyone, any comment from the public? Item 8.01, model classroom review and update.
Good evening. I'm Kim, and I have the pleasure of being here with Jennifer O'Hagan and James McMillan to give you an update on model technology classrooms. I think we better start calling them technology classrooms because we might start some kind of model classroom when it comes to Measure D. So we're talking about the technology type of model classroom. So tonight we want to give you kind of an update on where we are as we're beginning round two. Look at the background on what we are trying to accomplish and the purpose of that and kind of some findings and conclusions and where we've landed with this. So what is a model classroom? What are we talking about? So we're talking about some omnivores, we think of it. It's the tech-hungry teachers that said, you know what, we're going to write a proposal, and if you give us devices, we know how we will make an instructional impact with our students with these devices. So that was kind of the idea. Let's start with people that really feel a hunger and a need and a desire for it, and let's see where they can go with this. So we started with one-to-one student devices. The teacher could also select their device. They would have a cart in the class for storage, for charging, and Wi-Fi access, a projector, and right now we have at least two model classrooms per site was part of round one, so we're moving along from there. So purpose, kind of what were we trying to accomplish? So if you think back, there was kind of two different sides, technical side and then the instructional side. So looking at from the technical side, from kind of the IS&T side of things, we said, you know, we need to explore some different solutions. There's iPads, there were Chromebooks, there were laptops, there were tablets. You know, we looked at some Samsung tablets, and we said, let's kind of pilot some of these. Let's try some of these out, and let's see what are the pros and cons. We started with our innovation committee that is comprised of teachers, administrators, and business and industry representatives, and we said, let's start to look at the pros and cons. We put a bunch of different devices out on the table and said, let's start to think about how can we narrow this down and what would be great for a classroom. Here's the kind of document. You're not expected to see that, but just as we started kind of bullet pros and cons of each. So we said after we're going to look at device solutions, we said let's start kind of evaluating compatibility. What works from the back end side of things? What works in the classroom? And let's look at that. Let's also think about sustainability. This is something we don't want to just have one time, you know, big push of this and then we can't sustain it. So let's start to think about how could we sustain this and what's a way to continue this momentum in the district. Then the other piece, we wanted to always make sure that we were meeting SBAC requirements. So that was one of the, just the ground floor minimum requirements. We said we're only going to order devices that you can use for SBAC testing. So from the instructional side, our purpose was we asked people two major questions. We said, how would you use this device to really personalize learning and to use a device for the science of differentiating, right? One of the hardest things, I think, for a classroom teacher, and a device can really be used to help teachers with that. So how can we do that? The other piece is we wanted to create that model. It's no coincidence that we called it Model Classrooms, because we found a lot of teachers there that said, we understand this is where kids are headed, this is the world they're going to walk into, but we don't quite know what that would look like for me in my classroom. But there were some teachers that said, give it to me, I'd love to dive in. So we wanted to kind of create what does that look like. Then we also wanted some site-level experts so that we could have professional development opportunities and people that would be right there on site with teachers so that they could help them begin to explore this idea. And the last is creating excitement, and it definitely does that. It creates a real buzz, and we've seen that that does happen. It creates an excitement for the students and for teachers. So I'm going to start telling you a little about the process, and then Jen will jump in. But it started with back in the fall 2013 when we were going around and initially gathering LCAP feedback. One of the questions we asked is, I said, you know, just tell me about where you see technology headed. What's that going to look like in your classroom, and where are things going? And we did get some valuable input here and there, but overall we kept hearing the pattern of teachers saying, you know, Kim, I see this is where we need to go this direction. I see this is what kids need to be able to utilize, but I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like for me on a day-to-day basis. And so that's where we kind of came up with the idea of, let's start with the people that are really hungry for it. Let's start with the ones that are willing to take a risk and go for it. And so that's kind of where we decided down that process of, let's get some proposals from people and see where we stand.
Okay, so last spring, winter and spring, we started with our round one model classrooms, and we had EdTech lead teachers, there's one at each site, submit a proposal where we asked them what device would they like to pilot or try out, and then how would they use that device to further engage students and differentiate the learning. And so they responded, and Kim and I were able to review and kind of give teacher feedback and things to help guide them as they move forward. And we spent the spring reviewing these proposals and approving them. And then we moved on to spring and summer, where we ordered the equipment to prepare for the classroom rollout. And so over the summer, we were ordering equipment and delivering it to the sites, to the classrooms. And so for fall 2014, we had our round one basically completed and in full swing. So we have now started round two last winter, and now rolling into spring with this same process. And so we have some conclusions to talk about, and James is actually going to start.
I think last time I was here presenting, I was using an iPad and showing off some new features that we'd hoped teachers would implement. So it's no coincidence that when we tried to divide and conquer with the first round of model classrooms, that I kind of focused on classrooms that had iPads, and Jen focused on classrooms that tried other options. So I'd like to speak to the conclusions that we made about iPads in model classrooms. This is a set of one-to-one iPads in the classroom. What we found to be the most beneficial was what you're seeing right now. An iPad is a powerful teaching device. It allows for teaching mobility. And I would love to present out here, but then it doesn't come with the mic, so I wanted to demonstrate that for you. We found that many teachers would prefer to teach with an iPad regardless of if they have a set of one-to-one devices or if they have a set of iPads, and Jen will speak to that a little bit. We also found that, particularly in primary grades, there are an abundance of apps that help enhance a primary student's education, whether it's in a small group or in a whole class, and being on a tablet is really conducive to a young learner. There were free and paid apps. Those were two big pros that we found from using iPads. There were a few drawbacks that we discovered, though. One of them, the biggest one, was that it is very difficult for IS&T to manage iPads. This is what we refer to as kind of an Apple challenge, not really a district challenge. So we've come up with a lot of solutions. We spent a lot of this past fall and winter coming up with solutions for our existing iPads in classrooms. But it remains very difficult for IS&T, and then particular for teachers. We know that teachers are busy and have a plethora of things to worry about, and managing content on devices is something that's becoming increasingly important, and we want to try and streamline it to make it as easy as possible. The other drawback, the major drawback from using iPads, is that it's not feasible in a shared environment. Now, what I refer to in a shared environment isn't necessarily an elementary school classroom where it would be a one-to-one device setting, but it would be in a middle school or high school class, for example, where you have different periods of students coming in. Same teacher, different students. So it is not possible for students to log in to an iPad where they can immediately have access to all their content, all their saved settings, all of the data that has been accumulated. That's a major issue for us. It's an issue that another device has seemed to solve, and I'll let Jennifer take over and tell you more about it.
Okay, so you can see Chromebooks have been the most popular device of choice, and I just want to tell you why. First of all, it's a seamless Google Apps for Education integration. So as you know, we have migrated over to Google, and when a student logs into a Chromebook, they're also logging into their Google Apps account, so they have immediate access to all of the features that Google's been offering. The Chromebook management piece, like James had spoken earlier with iPads, does not require IS&T. Teachers can do it seamlessly, quickly. They can push out educational apps to particular students or to their whole class. They can pull them back, and it's immediate. And all of these apps are free, they're ad-free, and they have been vetted by other classroom teachers. It's software compatible with many of our current existing software that we're using across the district, elementary through high school, so you'll see students no longer need to necessarily go to the computer lab. They can stay in their classroom and access the existing software, which saves a lot of time. The cost is about half the price of an iPad, so that's going to really help with future replacement and repair as we look forward, looks to the future. And again, like James said, it's shared easily in an environment. So, for instance, when we use that example of high school, a first period can come in, log into a Chromebook, and then log out, and the next period can come in and log into that same Chromebook where their device and data settings are saved. So it's a very shareable device, and it makes it very easy. And again, like Kim mentioned earlier, it's SBAC compatible. So hopefully as we move forward, we'll be able to service more kids that way. So on this next slide, I just wanted to show you a quick 2-minute video on what a Chromebook actually is, because it is a little bit different than a laptop, and this will kind of show you how it functions in an academic environment.
Introducing Chromebooks for Education, a simple way to bring the power of the web into the classroom. manage school-wide sets of hardware, and keep students focused. For instance, Chromebooks leave more time for teaching by booting up in just 8 seconds. That's less time than it takes to make a paper airplane. Even after entering sleep mode, they resume working immediately. And unlike most notebook computers, Chromebooks have a battery that lasts up to 8 hours. So even at the end of a long school day, they're still going strong. Built-in Wi-Fi and optional 3G allow Chromebooks to connect to the web anytime, anywhere. Chromebooks are also built around a web browser, which means everything is stored online. Students and teachers can simply log on to any machine to access their emails, documents, and personal settings. So there are no more excuses for missing or incomplete homework. Without the need for constant software updates and yearly reimaging, Chromebooks make it easy to provide each student with their own computer. Schools can manage an entire fleet of Chromebooks with just a few clicks. Administrators can configure and manage computers and user accounts via a web-based console. They can also control which web apps and extensions users can add. Chromebooks stay up to date with the latest features and fixes, so IT managers can spend less time updating hardware and more time focusing on the important things. Integrated security provides multiple layers of protection that defends computers and the entire network from malware and viruses. The Chromebooks for Education program includes everything from the computers and operating system to updates, web-based management, and extended warranty and support from Google. At the end of the day, Chromebooks for Education enables schools to be more efficient in terms of classroom time, IT resources, and technology budgets, which ultimately leads to happier teachers, students, and parents. To find out more about getting Chromebooks for your school...
Okay, so these next couple of slides, I hope that gives you a little snippet of, as to what a Chromebook does. I think it would be really powerful for you to actually hear from the users. So I went around, and James and I both did, and went around and interviewed some administrators and model classroom teachers, and we asked them a few guiding questions, and I have another two-minute video to show you in just a moment. The guiding questions that we asked these teachers was were, what impact have you seen in your classroom by having a one-to-one model? We also asked them, how has it engaged students, and how has it helped you to differentiate? So watch and learn.
The model classrooms at Sinsheimer have been, they've really been transformative, to be honest with you. What we're seeing in those classrooms is just a heightened level of collaboration, not only between the teacher and the student, but between students themselves. They've allowed students to be working on different things at different times. So you might have 10 different students in the classroom working on 10 different things, but they're all really valuable. One might be doing some nonfiction reading on Newsela. Another one might be working on their crafting their writing piece and giving feedback to another student. And one might be working on one of their projects in the classroom. And communicating with others or doing research. And so it's allowed that teacher to kind of freed that teacher up to be more of the facilitator in the classroom as opposed to being up on in front of the classroom by the whiteboard directing 30 students at one time. One of the other things I've really noticed is that the creativity that's coming out of the student work is tremendous. So when you just kind of break down some of those barriers that we traditionally have in classrooms without the technology, it just frees them up to be super creative and do things that are incredible.
Some of the positives that I've seen around one-to-one model classrooms is students having access to knowledge that they've never had in the past. So we've asked students to independently use devices to answer driving or critical questions that teachers are asking in class. And as we know, styles around finding information differ. So each student is able to use their own style, whether it in a group or individual, and use that device to access knowledge on their own.
The one-to-one model, first of all, has really helped me modify the way I plan lessons. I no longer am now restricted on having to find a computer lab. Now I can just create lessons, and the sky's the limit as far as technology is concerned. I can ask a question, and if I don't know the answer, the students know the answer, we can immediately find the answer online. We can create documents together, we can explore websites together, we can do research together. So it's completely opened up the way I plan and create lessons.
I feel it's so important because it's just what kids should be learning. They should have a computer in front of them because that's the way they need to operate in our world now.
I have loved being in the model classroom, especially because I've been able to do more with project-based learning with social studies, and the projects are shared on Google Slides, so all students are looking at the same slide at the same time. They can be working on different slides, they can be working together on one slide, and they're all seeing the same thing at the same time.
In the class, you have all your students working on essays. You can be in one spot and reading through essays and actually sending them comments through the computer. So you're not even needing to disturb the silence of the classroom, interacting and chatting with students real time, which they love to be chatting on the computer, so it is also a big engagement piece for us as well.
It's been amazing to see just the buzz that's been generated and the interest within the kids. I find it's really amazing that they're linking their social and home life and abilities with what's happening in school. Being able to access their documents from school with and the same amount of ease at home. Being able to collaborate with classmates inside school and outside school with ease. Getting feedback instantly, whether it's creating Google Docs and having comments or collaboration projects where they're bouncing ideas off of each other. So it's been really cool to see the excitement, the buzz, the ease of use, and watching their minds and see what they can do with it.
So there you heard from teachers and administrators, and I'd like you to also hear from students. We asked a few students these questions. How has your device changed how you learn new information? And what is something you do on these devices that you weren't able to do before?
With Google, we have nothing to worry about losing documents. I'm sure we've all had the problem of typing an important essay, exiting out without saving it, and then you lose it. With Google Docs, that's no problem because it saves it word by word every second.
It's a lot easier to find things on our Chromebooks because before, we would always have to wait until it was like our time in the library to go look things up. So if we don't know how to spell a word and it's not in the dictionary, then we can just look it up on our computers. Because it's right there at the top of our desk. We don't do homework on paper anymore, so because our teacher always sends us our homework through her website, so there's no paper used anymore. We really use Google Drive to its fullest advantage to type all the stuff that we would normally write, and his spell check too.
Then we have more time inside the classroom, and we don't have to come into the computer lab. And so we can take AR quizzes during reading time. No one's just opening them and doing stuff on it. So I think it's helping us a lot.
I like the Chromebooks because they're easier than the Windows 7 that we have in the computer lab. I like that they're small and they're useful for getting things done quicker. It's changed the way of my learning because I can, I have more access to things.
There's times in our English class where we have to do a research project and he wants them by the end of class, and using these devices really helps me in my time. I get my job done even quicker. We usually connect with other people and we show our projects to other people, and pretty much other people comment on the projects we finished, like if like we did a good job or not. Yeah. So we pretty much stay connected, by the Chromebooks.
Like all of our stuff saves on the device when we log in. We don't really have to like carry lots of stuff to our class anymore, so we just use the computer to like research everything.
It helps communicating because sometimes we can kind of chat with each other online with Google Docs, and it's a lot easier so you don't have to like yell across the room. And then when your teacher sends you assignments, you don't have to waste paper, so it's environmentally friendly. Another thing that we can do with our Chromebooks that we couldn't do before is, before when we wrote essays and then our teacher gave us comments like, oh, you need to start a new paragraph, we would have to rewrite it to make it look nice. And on here, it's really easy for us to just go on, change it, and it will save automatically.
I think the iPads in the classroom are really great because they allow us to like
do Google, like Google Docs, share stuff with each other. It's really cool having technology in the class.
So I hope that gives you a little snippet, a little window of what we're seeing across the district.
So I'm going to conclude by telling you about where we stand now and our plans for the future and the implications that it has, not just on what you can see based on the excitement and the engagement that's occurring, but the effect that it'll have on our students' achievement as well. This is a current Google Doc that us administrators are constantly working on. And don't worry about the details, but anything that you see in green is a fully outfitted one-to-one, or what we determine is an appropriate amount, classroom. So we have our schools listed at the top, and we go all the way from our elementary to high schools. I know the green and the yellow kind of look similar on that display. I apologize. Yellow means that we are moving in the direction we've started. What we've noticed, what we've decided, I should say, is that in a primary grade classroom, based on economics as well as usability, one-to-one isn't necessarily where we might want to be headed at this time. It might be more of a six-to-one in a kindergarten class, and it might be tablets instead of a Chromebook. That has allowed us actually to repurpose some of our iPads that were in classrooms and put them back in small groups for other grades to use. Is that my key to speed up? Is that okay? So what you would see right now, if you go out to every site, elementary through high school, is at least two fully outfitted model classrooms. You will see mostly Chromebooks in those classrooms. That's really what we have started to head in the direction of. The first round was a mix of Chromebooks, iPads, and some laptops. And this second round, we're seeing all Chromebooks, but we're still continuing to support and use to the full advantage of these other devices. We're really excited to say that a couple of our whole school sites or whole grade levels are actually already one-to-one. Pacific Beach High School is a one-to-one school. Teach Elementary School is a one-to-one school. As of this week, even, some sixth grade teachers are getting their Chromebooks. And this is our round two, and really our round two is meant for the next instructional year, but we're happy to get them in the classrooms now and let teachers start using them right away. Many of them are planning to use them for SBAC assessments. So by the end of this year, sixth grade across the district will be one-to-one. That's significant, in particular with our math pilot curriculum that we're going to be using, the CPM curriculum next year as well, because there's a big technology component. And lastly, Los Osos Middle School, by next year, will be a one-to-one school. They're one grade short, and I think the devices have been ordered. They're on their way. Our next steps in this whole process, of course, have to involve professional development. And that's where Jen and I, under Kim's direction, take part. A lot of that happens with EdTech lead teachers that are on site. They were mostly the first round model classroom users. As Kim mentioned, we fed the hungry first. We wanted to get the teachers that were just chomping at the bit, despite all the Common Core, despite all of the other things that they are really working on with integrity. And we fed them. They're the resource at the site level. Jen and I try and travel around to all the sites and help as much as we can, but we encourage them to be the resource. We offer a lot of optional professional development as well, and one big event that we're planning right now is going to happen in the summer after school is out. It's going to be an optional paid professional development. We're going to call it a Google summer boot camp, and it's going to be put on by our teacher experts as well as ourselves, and we hope to offer those that are interested the opportunity to learn more. Jen mentioned that another benefit of Chromebooks is the cost. They're very inexpensive, and in particular, if they need to be repaired, they're also inexpensive. We are also aware that they do not last forever, and so we are incorporating a plan to replace them as the manufacturers predict when the lifespan will end on them. And we hope to expand. What next year will bring, we don't know, but if there's a round three, we'd love to come back and tell you about it. This is all in an effort to really move on up what we have found and what we really use as our guide, the SAMR model. Kim McGrath has spoke to you about it before. And this sums up what the SAMR model does. We want it to transform learning. This is one of our eager teachers who tomorrow, I believe, will get Chromebooks to her classroom. She's wearing her Pi shirt, I think, on Pi Day. So this is the SAMR model, in case you're not familiar yet. And where we want to be is at the top end of the model, the redefinition phase and the modification. Where we are in many instances at first is in this substitution level, and we're actually okay with that. There's no immediate expectation that just because a teacher is interested or tech savvy that they're automatically going to have a redefined classroom. If that existed, we would have already bought it and implemented it. This is all in a process of learning and discovering. So many teachers are starting at the substitution level. Now, that being said, we're already witnessing almost on a daily basis numerous lessons that tend to live here, the augmentation and modification. And to bring us home, I'd like to demonstrate what the students came up with themselves using their devices in a 15-second little video clip. This was all student-made. This is what we like to see SAMR in action.
Hey, Isabella. Okay, I just shared a document with you. Can you please read the first section while I finish the last one?
Okay, I just found some great information that we could totally use on this report.
Sweet. What website is it at?
I can't remember, but I'll email it to you.
Okay, I'm down.
All right, we'd love to answer any questions you have. Thank you for your time.
Okay, Mr. Buckman and Mr. Unger.
Chris, is it okay?
Sure.
Okay. So, let me ask my first one. I tend to try to avoid Google as much as possible because my sense is they track me more than any other whatever out there. I mean, I put in a search for a car that I'm interested in, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the New York Times, the ad comes up for the car. So there's laws against tracking kids. It's just huge issue for me about using kids and using marketing. So what kind of assurances do we have from Google on that?
Fantastic question, and some parents have actually come forth with the same concern. I'll let Kim speak to it, but I can tell you right away that a GAFI, a Google Apps for Education account, is in many ways different than a personal Google or Gmail account. And we just went to a conference, and security and privacy is at the top of the list. So she can maybe speak to more details, but I can start by saying that the two are different in that way. Our students don't see advertisements. Google says that they're not tracking the students' data and web searches and emails.
Yeah, that's what they told me when I called.
Yeah, okay. So the difference does lie in that it's a GAFI account, and it's through our filtered system, just the same as any other internet access.
So just one other quick question. So I'm using this at school. It sounds like I have my own login. I can get in, and everything's nice. And so I'm at home. Do I have access to this from this? I guess it's probably not from an Apple, but from a PC computer?
You do. That's the beauty of it. And there's one caveat.
Yeah.
When you're at home, you're not on the district filtered network.
Okay.
Some of parents of students at my school found that out the hard way. So when they log in to their GAFI account at home, everything that they have in their Google Drive, every document that they've shared with their teacher or collaborated on with friends, and every assignment that they've been working on in conjunction with their teacher through Google Classroom is available. It opens up a lot of access. You can use Google offline as well. You have to, now we don't have students taking home devices at this time. In the future, I know we're going to probably broach that, and we might look at students using their own devices. That would ensure access to those that don't have the internet access. But they can log in with ease, even from the Mac, even from the iPad. But again, they're on their parent-controlled internet at that point, not the district-filtered internet.
So one interesting thing you just mentioned was you can access it without being logged in. So you mean logged into the internet? Is that
correct?
So I could go home and I could somehow work on my stuff, but if I didn't have internet at home?
Correct. And then if you were to come back to school with the device you were using, it would sync up.
Okay.
Kind of a thing.
And then to one of my favorite questions. So we have the achievement gap, and then we have the technology gap.
Certainly.
So kid that's in a house with a PC gets to work. And the only difference then, which is exciting, is what I'm hearing. Let me understand what I'm hearing is. So one's working in the cloud right then, but the other kid could be, well, somebody that doesn't have a computer is going to be in a different situation than somebody that does. It's the bottom line.
Right, right. And we have that before this as well. I mean, that always is the gap. So as we explore possibilities of taking devices home in the future and things, I mean, we do hope to bridge that gap. Again, the beauty of Google, you could literally, if parents have a cell phone or a smartphone but they don't have a computer in the house, you could literally log into Google on the smartphone and still work on it. You pointed to your Mac just now. It works on any compatible device, not just a Chromebook. The Chromebook is just optimized for Google.
Okay.
So we hope that it opens up more access as we move forward.
So I will love to be the first one to donate a Chromebook to a lending library. We can start those. Thanks.
Can I speak to that? We do have, both of our high schools are implementing a checkout program now with Chromebooks. So that's hopefully going to help with this gap.
Yeah. And it'll only be one, Marilyn.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask pretty much the same question about access for our students as Mark just did, because I know even on our elementary school levels, I think that some of our teachers prefer that the homework be done online and forwarded to them through the Google Apps. And my concern is, I think, is the same as Mark's, which is we have a whole bunch of students that don't have access to computers. And if it's something like homework, that worries me about how are these kids going to get their stuff in on time. The accuracy would be different. So I think that's something philosophically that is going to have to be looked at. That's just a comment, since you already answered the question. And then the second thing, I've just got to ask, is it true there's no caps lock on the Chromebooks?
Well, I have another video that I can show you, but I won't tonight, that shows you all the shortcuts. But yes, that can be enabled, but they had to disable it to add another button.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Coming up soon.
Have you conducted any kind of survey to determine how many students in our district don't have access from home?
We have not conducted it district-wide, no. Some sites have done that, and I think as we get further along, it's something we'll definitely look at. But there's also some other changes in the community coming that we think might be helpful to us, and we have not conducted it district-wide yet.
Okay, thank you. Marilyn.
Thank you. Mr. McMillan, I just wanted to confirm my understanding of your back and forth with Mr. Buckman. Because I know several people who actually have computers but can't afford internet access, did I understand correctly that students could work on a computer that's home-based but not connected to the internet, and then would they be taking that computer to school the following day and somehow downloading the work they've done? Or how does it work?
There's
if it works.
It does work. There's a couple options. And as simple as while they're at school, the Chromebooks have a USB port on them. So you can plug in a flash drive and store anything, any document, any text you're working on, pictures, photos, or a presentation that you're working on. Remove the flash drive, take it home, plug it into your home computer, and you continue working on it without an internet connection.
Okay.
When you bring it back to school the next day, you plug it into your Chromebook there, and it syncs right up. And if others are collaborating in the meantime, everything kind of syncs up. So that's one option. That's probably the best option until we explore the possibility of taking devices home. But when a student takes, say, a Chromebook home, there's an offline mode, and you can either fire it up while you're at school and while you have a connection, click offline mode, and it kind of does some extra thinking because it knows it's going to need to kind of do some storage work while it's at home. They do have a storage capacity. It's big enough for student use. They take it home, they do their work, it remembers, and then it syncs it up, and then you can put it back online when you come back to school. Devil is in the details.
It's fabulous. I think even I understood that. And it's been suggested that I have a rotary cell phone. So thanks for the simple explanation.
Just think of it. It's magic. It's just magic.
It just happens.
It just happens. Mr. Buckman.
So I'm getting more and more excited about this. So I have to just, this will be the last one. But so if I have an old PC or a Mac that, like the two or three, four dozen that are out in my garage, could I donate that? And does it need some kind of special software that we could provide? Or, I mean, I'm assuming there's, we could talk about this some other time.
Yeah, and I think we probably will, because we do want to see this continue to expand, and we know there will be limitations based on the students that we interact with. So I think we'll come up with workarounds. We'll come up with we'll try and do a generalized one-size-fits-all and also bring along everyone else to make sure we're not excluding anyone. So I love working on that kind of stuff. So let's have coffee.
Okay, anyone else? Thank you. Thank you for your informative and interesting presentation. Thanks a lot. Okay, item 8.02 is introduction to Pacheco 9010 option.
Yeah, let me just introduce this for a moment. Moving from a model classroom to one of our model schools, Pacheco, I think must be about 19 years now, has been doing dual language immersion as one of our most popular elementary schools, a waiting list to get into it year after year. About a year ago, Principal Mr. Mayfield and I were chatting, and he had a real interest in exploring and moving to the possibility of a 90-10 dual immersion program as opposed to the 50-50 program that they've been doing for the past couple of decades. And my encouragement was to explore it and research it and start talking to the people who are most involved, his staff, his potential parents, and to kind of see whether this is something that he could bring back and share some insights. And so that's the purpose of tonight's meeting, is to let you know what that school has gleaned in terms of this actually probably more popular model of doing dual immersion language instruction. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Mayfield.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robin. I appreciate that. Yeah, we're here tonight to share a proposal to change our program from 50-50 to 90-10. And it's a significant enough change that it would require the board to let us know whether or not you think this is the direction our school should move in. But it's not as significant a change in what we do as many people assume. And I'll share with you what I mean by that tonight. I also would like to apologize that this presentation wasn't done earlier in the school year. It should have been brought before you by the fall, and that didn't happen. So I apologize for that. Okay, change. That's the name of the game. Someone said that if someone from 200 years ago in time came to today's world, the only institution they would recognize are the public schools. And we have spent a lot of time changing that in this district in the last few years. I'm proud of the work that we've done. 20 years ago, this is year 19 of the two-way immersion program, and 20 years ago we set out to see how can we serve the growing number of English learner students in our school district, and this is the data that we went to. And what it shows here on the far right are the different program models for English learner students. Along the bottom are grade levels from kindergarten through 11th grade, and it shows the effectiveness of the different program models. And the top line there, of course, is two-way dual language education. And this was the research that prompted us to start our two-way immersion program. We are, first and foremost, an intervention for English learner students. Pacheco's first and primary goal is as an intervention for English learner students, because two-way immersion is the most powerful way to help these students acquire English and be successful over the long term. This research that was done all across the country with 700,000 students is reflected in our own data within the school district. These are our goals that were established back in 1996. We want to teach, they've been updated for Common Core, of course, but teach rigorous content to all students in two languages. We don't water it down. We teach the same curriculum at Pacheco that every other school, district school teaches. Our second goal is to have all students exit bilingual and biliterate in English and Spanish by the end of sixth grade. And then the last goal is to give students a sense of cultural diversity. And all three of these goals to us are equally important. And all three of these goals will remain just as they're written under a 90-10 program, just as they are under a 50-50 program. No change to the goals whatsoever. As I told the English-speaking parents when I met with them, look at that second goal. You folks already committed to the idea of your child becoming bilingual and biliterate. And we're simply tweaking our program and adjusting our program to make it the most powerful that it can be. These are some of the things that we looked at in change. You know, we have a continuous improvement cycle. We have to look at the work that our students are doing, the things that they're able to produce, and make the program better so that they can be more successful. We have new demands with Common Core. For English-speaking students, half of their instructional time is spent in Spanish from about grade 3 up. And for them to be successful in Common Core instruction, half of the time, they need to have command of the Spanish language. And we're seeing some weaknesses there, and this program adjustment would take care of that. We need to monitor the work that our students are doing and adjust our program accordingly. This is part of that. And then data cycle is something as a district we've embraced in the last few years, and I really like it myself. I know our teachers do as well. We look at the students' work, we look at what they're able to do, and then we adjust our instruction accordingly and our program accordingly. And that's what this is about. The graphic on the right, you know, we're at the, you know, somewhere down in the uncertainty transition phase, but we've gathered some good data, and we are convinced, all of us as a team, that when we get to the new status quo, we're going to see increased results for all our students. We're going to see that two-way immersion be the most powerful that it can be. This is some of the data that we've looked at. It's a little bit old. It's 2013. It's the last year of CST data. You know, we're in transition when it comes to data collecting for our program, and we have some in-house assessments that we look at. But this is, you know, comparing what do our students do compared to the rest of the students in the state and compared to the students in English-only programs in the school. That top line, the dark blue line, those are English-only Pacheco students. The dashed line below it in blue are English-only, the rest of the school district's English-speaking students. Okay, the lines on the bottom, unfortunately, the dark red line are Pacheco English learner students, and the reddish dashed line are the rest of the school district's English learner students. And our goal in putting the data up here like this is not to compare schools, but simply to say, what does it look like in two-way immersion versus English-only instruction? And you can see, if looking at the red lines on the bottom, that by sixth grade, our students are starting to close that achievement gap. They're catching up a little bit with the state averages for all students, but there still exists quite a gap between the English speakers and the English learners. And Pacheco, being a program that's designed as an intervention for English learners, it needs to be the most powerful that it can be to address these students' needs. And you see what happens to them after sixth grade. And, you know, this is data that we all take very seriously and look at and say, you know, what can we do to address this? This is Cassie High School Exit Exam data. The green lines are the first olive green line are Pacheco former EL students. The lighter green line are the rest of the school district's English learner students. And the blue lines are Pacheco versus the rest of the district. And we're looking to even those lines out and close that achievement gap, and we feel that this transition would do that. There are three primary reasons for the change. Number one is that Spanish needs to be higher for English learner students. What the research says and what we've discovered anecdotally over time is when Spanish is high, the transition to English is smooth and successful. when Spanish is, you know, about in the middle, the transition's about in the middle. And when Spanish is low, the transition is difficult. English in our community and really in the whole state just seeps into everything. Students more and more come to school with, you know, watered down Spanish, or even our English learners, and we really need to focus on beefing up that Spanish so that it'll be high and the transition will be successful. That's number one. Number two, as I mentioned earlier, our native English-speaking students spend half of their time in rigorous content in Spanish, and they need to have mastery of that content in order to be successful and maximize that instructional time. And it needs to be, they need to spend more time in Spanish to gain that mastery. And I'll share a slide in a minute about how much time they do spend in Spanish instruction. The top bullet here on added benefits, we could make this transition for this bullet alone. And currently in a 50-50 model, what we do kindergarten through second grade is we instruct students in their native language. So we have all the English learners in one classroom in Spanish instruction, and all the native English speakers in one classroom in English instruction. So we segregate the students by language. But by doing so, we also segregate them by ethnicity. We have seen the results of that, some of the results of that on the playground. The parents have seen the results of that on the playground. And we, all of us, feel it's not the right message to send to students. The majority of 50-50 programs keep the students together all day long, and then they spend 50% of their time in English, 50% of their time in Spanish. So keeping students grouped together all day long, which would occur in a 90-10, half native English speakers, half native Spanish speakers, is a huge bonus to this move. And then the last bullet there, we really want all of our families to make a commitment to all three of our school goals. We have, I'll leave it at that. What does the research say? The majority of two-way immersion programs in the state of California and in the country are 90-10 model programs. What the research says, and Catherine Lindholm-Leary, who is cited in this slide up here, is our evaluator. She has been our evaluator for 19 years. If you do any kind of looking into the research on two-way immersion, her name will appear in almost every publication. And she's very excited about this possibility. So what it says is both English and Spanish students have higher Spanish proficiency outcomes with no detrimental effect to their English development in the long run. So if students, K-2, are studying Spanish language arts first, of course you might see in third grade and initial testing somewhat lower results in English. But over time, they will catch up and exceed grade level expectations in English language arts. This is the slide I was referring to earlier. If you're an English speaker, every other week looks like this for you. The blue line being the amount of time you spend in English, and the red line being the amount of time you spend in Spanish. And what we found is it's not adequate to give the students the oral fluency they need and the strength in Spanish they need to get the Common Core instruction in Spanish as they move up through the grade levels. Okay, so what would it look like in a 90-10 program? In a 90-10 program, kindergarten to second grade, all students would learn literacy and Spanish language arts first. All four of our kindergarten classrooms would be Spanish classrooms 90% of the time. And 10% of the time would be in English instruction. That would change from year to year. So in first grade, it would then move to 80-20. In second grade, it would move to 70-30. And third grade, 60-40. And then the rest of the years would look just about like they do now. So really, third grade and up would look very similar to what it looks like right now. And kindergarten to second grade is where the difference would be. We would have also an articulated ELD program from kindergarten through sixth grade so that we would know exactly what we're doing during that 10% of the instructional time. And we would get that from, you know, working with our own district staff. We're working currently with the ELD specialists at Cal Poly to throw around some ideas. And we've toured some schools throughout the state 90-10 programs to inquire as to how they do that ELD part of their instruction. Grades 2 and 3 would be transition years to reading in the second language in English, and then 4 through 6, all subjects would be taught half the time in English and half the time in Spanish, as they are now. We talked to our parents. We wanted to see, you know, how they felt about this change, and we did a presentation with our English-only parents and our Spanish-speaking parents. And these are the results of the current Pacheco parents who have younger siblings coming up into the school in the future. So these are the folks who are whose children are going to be there in the program in this new model if it gets approved. And these are the results of that survey. So of the 56 that we surveyed, 51 were on board with the change and very excited about it, and 5 were a little bit unsure. They had the possibility of clicking on both boxes, and 3 of the 5 clicked the on board, but they were still a little unsure about the changes. And there were none that were opposed to the changes at all. Some of the comments, I got many emails, and I asked parents at that meeting to let me know how they feel. I said, if you don't feel comfortable sharing in a meeting format, and I certainly understand that, by all means, send me an email. Let me know how you feel. I need to know what you're thinking about this change. And this is a common response that I got. I'm so excited about this possibility. I came into the meeting worried about my incoming 4-year-old, and I left the meeting worried about my 7-year-old. They're already there in the program. And then the last one was from an English learner parent who shared that I was doubtful about Spanish making English stronger until I saw it work with my older daughter. We did a teacher survey as well. We presented to staff, talked about it with staff, and said, okay, well, how do you guys feel about this change? 27 teachers were surveyed. 23 said they were in support, and 3 of those 23 said perhaps we need a little more time. 3 teachers were unsure if this was the direction our school should head in, and 1 was opposed to us going to the 90-10 program model. So to summarize, our key goals, our school goals, would not change. Bilingualism, biliteracy, and cultural awareness remain exactly the same. Spanish literacy first for English learners would not change under a 90-10 program. The research supports this type of program model. If it were to be approved, it would be introduced in kindergarten only the first year, and we would add 1 year at a time. So the students who are currently in kindergarten would move through first through sixth grade, just like they always have in a 50-50 model program. And this would only affect next year's, or whatever year we decide to do this, next year's kindergartners and beyond. We would also maintain our 50% native English speakers, 50% native Spanish speakers clientele. We feel that's important to the success of the program. And right now, we have enough students. The open enrollment closes the 31st of March, but right now we have enough students signed up to conduct a lottery on the English side of things. And I've also been sharing that we have a proposal in front of the board for moving to 90-10 with the incoming parents for orientation, and we've received you can tell just by the numbers who have applied, but we've received a favorable response from that as well. Okay,
I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
I want to know how this affects current staffing and into the next few years at Pacheco.
Yeah. We would need to move some staff around because, as I said, kindergarten through second grade, it would require fully bilingual staff. But nobody would need to be transferred out of the school. Teachers might elect to stay at a certain grade level and would elect to transfer to remain in that grade level, but nobody would be required to leave. We would be able to move staff around within grade levels within the school to keep all current staff, you know, working at Pacheco Elementary School. One of the things I shared with staff when we discussed it is that there are currently 5 teachers who are monolingual English speakers on our staff, and I said, you guys are an important part of this program, and if you're on board with what we have going on, we've got a spot for you at Pacheco School.
Okay, and then I just have a comment before I turn it over to other board members, and that is, you know, I get a concern I have is that we've been demanding, requiring, asking so much more of our teachers in the district, particularly our elementary teachers, that I do have concerns about, even if it's just at one side, about one more change, one more thing that we're asking them to rethink and vamp how they're teaching in their classrooms. Even if it's one grade, there will be reverberations throughout the school as the first grade teachers prepare to for the change that they'll have the following year, and the second grade teachers the year after that. So that's just more a comment than a question. So,
okay.
But it is a concern.
Sure. If I may.
Sure.
Two-way immersion is what we do. It's what we've been doing for the last 19 years. So in that regard, it doesn't change. Currently, the kindergarten teachers have those mixed group of students in their classroom that they're teaching Spanish to now, just like they would under a 90-10 model program. It would just be adjusting the amount of time students spend and perhaps the subject that students spends, you know, in that language. But this is what teachers have been doing. Also, in the discussions with staff, you know, I've got teachers chomping at the bit to be in that kindergarten group and ready to go, and in first grade as well, ready to go with this change. They're very excited about what it will do for all the students in our school and how powerful it will be for them. And so they're an amazing group of people. Like you said, the changes that have come down from the district, there have been a lot of them. And, for example, Lucy Calkins' writing is a curriculum only in English. And the teachers say, okay, we got to have this in Spanish. I'm teaching in Spanish. And they convert the material in that to the Spanish language. So this is what we've been doing for 19 years, and it's an adjustment to what we've been doing. But it's not anything totally different than what teachers have been accustomed to doing.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Buckman?
Thank you. Hello, Pacheco. Been there, visited often. Just a quick question, so I understand the data that you're giving us. Mm-hmm. When you talk about 56 parents, is that a percent that you can put to that? What percent of parents that was?
Well, we're assuming that's almost all of the parents, or all of the parents. All of the parents were contacted who have children coming into our school. These are of current Pacheco families on both the English learner side and the English side. And there were 57, I think, was the number that that attended the meeting and who we could identify as having young children who were going to come into our program. So my assumption is all of the parents at our school who have young siblings coming into the program had a chance to participate in the survey.
So let me just repeat so I understand. So the 57 were not current parents. They're parents with kids coming in.
They're current parents with kids coming in.
Got it. Thank you.
Ms. Eisendrath Rogers, then Mrs. Rogers.
Hi, Rick.
Hi.
I just need a little quick history lesson
here.
So 19 years ago when this program started, the notion was that it was, as I recall, it was expressed this way, that it's better for a student to learn their early education in their native language, whether that native language is English or in Spanish.
Right.
But now we're rethinking that. And so in order to be able to answer questions about, well, is this like the new math? You know, we did it that way then, and then we realized that maybe that's not the right way to do it. How would we respond to those questions about why do we feel that what we were doing 19 years ago was not the way that, you know, have the data. I can see the data over the 19 years. But So explain that. Why no longer the native speaking?
Okay, sure. Absolutely. I wasn't on the initial committee. I was there the first year as a teacher of the program that started 19 years ago, but I was not on the committee, so I'm not privy to the discussions that occurred. I would imagine when they looked into the research, they saw that 90-10 is the program model that is responsible for producing those results. But what we look at now is what are students able to do? What are we seeing our students do, and how can we effectively change our program to meet all these students' needs? We have two very distinct populations of students at our school. That dark blue line up there are the native English-speaking students that attend Pacheco School. I mean, they are almost literally off the charts. This is a group of students that is primed for success. They come to school with high vocabulary, ready to go. And I would love to say that that is entirely the result of a great program at Pacheco School, but of course that's not the case. That's a self-selected group of students whose families are there to support them to make this possible. these students, I think, in my estimation, these students will take the most advantage of this change and will see the greatest benefit from the change.
Okay. Thank you. That works for me. Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mayfield.
Yes.
I understand everything that you've explained to us here tonight, and I thank you for this presentation. I think that there is another component that we haven't discussed that I would call social integration of students.
Yeah.
Would you care to speak about that at all?
I would love to. Thank you. Where do we have the three goals? Iron. So the top bullet there, the added benefit of having students together all day long. What we have seen is that, and we've tried every catchphrase and warm and fuzzy phrase we can with the students. So in the morning when the kindergarten teachers, you know, have the students go to language arts, you know, we've had times where we say, okay, the English experts, you know, can line up at the door and the Spanish experts can go over here. But what we see is we're segregating students. You know, we have all the English learners together and all the English speakers together. There's not a body of research out there that supports that notion, segregating students. We segregate by language, but essentially we're segregating by ethnicity. In third grade, that occurs until 11:15 in the morning, and that sends a powerful message to students. I mean, if a school is saying, okay, you know, Anglo students over here, Latino students over here, what message does that send? And one of the three primary reasons for making this change is that we would be able to integrate students all day long, which research does support, and send the message that we are all bilingual, we are all language learners, and we're all experts in both languages. It's a primary reason for making this change, and an important one.
Yeah, I think it's very important as well. Thank you for explaining it.
Thank you.
Mr. Milan.
Rick, first of all, I remember, I wasn't on the board, but I remember the board voting to make Pacheco a special school, which was a step that the board had to take to avoid the UNS initiative,
correct,
which was going to prohibit teaching EL kids in Spanish.
Yeah.
One of the meanest, cruelest things that the referendum system in California often gives to us. So I was thrilled when the board made that decision. Over the years, I've always been worried that the enrichment portion for English language kids mm-hmm. outweighed some of the support that an achievement gap closing that kind of hoped for with the Spanish language kids.
Right.
So as I understand it, initially for like K and first, this is really not going to be a major change in the program.
Not for the English learners.
Okay.
It'll just be a more, you know, intense focus on Spanish instruction, Spanish okay. language arts.
And I did have a comment made to me by a esteemed member of the public in our district, who was expressing concern because his daughter, who was an English speaker, struggled with acquiring the Spanish early on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was worried about that. And he said he was worried about it becoming more of a self-selecting school. Now, I didn't really have a chance to explore that with him because literally I was getting ready to drive up here. And thinking back on it, I don't know whether he meant that more we would see more EL students selecting Pacheco as opposed to our Spanish language students selecting Pacheco. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure about that piece. Do you have I really have a problem with when we set up systems, our unintended consequences is this sort of
correct.
Separation of kids.
Right.
So
right.
Any thoughts about that?
Yeah. One of the reasons that students struggle with Spanish, especially native English speakers, is this slide here. The blue line, again, indicating the amount of time they spend in English instruction, and the red line, the amount of time they spend in Spanish instruction during their English week. So this would be every other week.
Oh, okay.
And then every other week, it's a little more. But what happens with that is, with a limited exposure to Spanish, kids don't have the opportunity to gain the confidence in Spanish that they need to be successful in the classroom. And I think that's what many of our parents, that the comment that one of the parents made, that I came into the meeting worried about my four-year-old, but I left the meeting worried about my seven-year-old. Yeah. That's what she was referring to.
Yeah.
And I, you know, don't know, of course, what that person was referring to, but I go out of my way to say this over and over again. We're a regular public elementary school open to all students who choose to attend Pacheco School. All students can be successful in a 90-10 immersion program. We had a blind native Mandarin speaker come to our program several years back. And we sat down with the parents and said, you know, are you sure that this is what you desire for your child? He's got to learn Braille, he's got to learn English, and you want him, and he's continuing with Mandarin, you want him to learn English? And they said, yep. I remember Dad said, Braille's not that hard. I said, okay. That child is in third grade, and you would be blown away by what he can do and how he operates in a classroom. It never ceases to amaze me what kids can do. And this tweak will really make this program as powerful as it can be for all students.
Good. Thank you, Rick.
Bet.
Mr. Mayfield, is it possible you brought some supporters with you? And if you'd like, we'd like to know who they are, and you
absolutely
might introduce them to us.
We have a committee of teachers and parents, and several of the parents had things going on tonight, and they couldn't make it in. But these are some of the people I was referring to who are chomping at the bit to make 90-10 happen. And they're here to answer any questions that you might have about, from a teacher's perspective or even a parent's perspective on the movement.
Would you please introduce them? If
absolutely. Come on up, everybody, together. Connie Reynoso is our coach. Jason Browning, Daria Hernandez, and Katie Collins are kindergarten teachers. And Mary Irons is a sixth grade teacher. Monica Garcia is a preschool teacher. And Monica, could you introduce her?
La señora Claudia Amador is one of our current preschool families that will be attending Pacheco Kindergarten next year.
Bienvenidos a todos.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
No questions, right?
Do any of you have any comments you'd like to make?
Any comments, please? At the
you
mic.
Need to come. You need to come to the microphone.
I kind of didn't want to have to say this because I was on that original committee when I was just a baby, and I started the same day you started, Rick, and exploring the options. You know, we did do the research, and at the time, what fit our district and just the community and the buy-in and everything that was going on was to just start with a 50-50 as a more conservative way of getting the EL students. And when I say EL, I hope you guys understand that means the Spanish-speaking students, that those are the students that we needed to have triage, crisis, intervention, get it going, because it wasn't happening in our district. There was no primary language taught at all until the year that we started the newcomers, and that was the year that I came in. And you know, when you say a lot of work, oh yeah, it's a lot of work, but when you're doing something like that and you see the effects that it has on the, especially the EL students and also the English-speaking students, how excited they are to speak Spanish. I have only taught in Spanish. In fact, I don't even know what it feels like to teach in English. So I'm used to that, but to see the enthusiasm and to see the kids, I don't know if any of you remember Gracie Manderscheid. I started working with her, and she said, and this is the kind of the key thing that is the aha, she said that the first year that we did the newcomers, what we did was we taught the Spanish speakers the curriculum in Spanish, and then they stayed in the afternoon and had the ESL with the regular kindergarten teachers. And they were completely like, this is the first time in my history of teaching that I've ever seen those kids, I'm sorry to refer to them as those kids, but that's how they said it, raising their hands, answering questions. They knew what was going on, and they were engaged, and they were involved, and they were communicating and learning and jumping in and not just sitting quietly in the back. Now that's from ancient days, okay? 19 years ago, those were the things that were being said. So through these years, teaching the kids the curriculum in a language that is solid and they can reason and figure things out and become thinkers like everybody else, that's what our goal is. And we just, over the years, I sound so old now, but over the years, less and less language is coming into the classroom, not just with the Spanish speakers, but English speakers also. The kids just don't have that beautiful, full language, so we have to give it to them. We have to do a lot of oral language development and really bombard them with a lot of language so that they have that to hold on to go further and to do those SBACs and all that Common Core. You need the language. So we're excited to do it. And, any questions or anybody that wants to come visit, classrooms are wide open anytime. I always tell you guys, come on in, see what the kids are doing. So I invite all of you to come in and see what's going on in Spanish in kindergarten. And it's only going to get better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ellen?
I just want to add that I was the person who did the survey during the Spanish speaking part with the parents, and they did it through text. And then I said, just to make sure we get it right, because we were having some issues, just to make sure we have it right, let's get a piece of paper and just put on there what you want so I can count these votes. Tell me how you really feel. And it gave me chills and, to count all of them, because at the end of the night, it was 26 out of 26. We want this change. We want our program to be stronger. And that uncomfortable graph that Rick just showed, uncomfortable for me and for many people because of distinct, you can see our distinct populations. It's like, yes, they're doing better, but it's not enough. We need more.
Thank you.
So I'm terrible at speaking in front of people. Most of the people I speak in front of are about 5 years old, and they're running around. And so I'll have to pretend that you guys are all kindergartners. My name is Jason Browning. I'm one of the kindergarten teachers at Pacheco Elementary School. And I had the pleasure of working at a 90-10 program in Paso Robles at Georgia Brown. And I wanted to speak to a couple of comments that Rick made in his presentation about integration and how important that is, that people are together and that people, because in my opinion, in my experience, what I've seen is that people develop relationships when they have mutual experiences. And everybody at Pacheco is together at times, but it just, for me, the whole idea of being together all the time, getting to know my core group of students all the time, being with them, knowing that what they need, their strengths, their weaknesses, and it's just a really powerful way to teach, I believe. I think there's the research out there is pretty clear about 90-10 programs, and I think about where we are now and where we could go, and I feel like for me there's a little bit of a sense of urgency in this because of the positive effects that a 90-10 program can have on kids, both English learners as well as primary language English speakers. And for me, the thought of this is kind of an urgent thing for me, because I don't want to see another group of kids coming through who would not benefit from being in a 90-10 program. I want those English language learners to be able to be more successful. That group of 80 kids or 44 kids or whatever it ends up being. I mean, for me, I think that's a really important thing for me to think about. And as well as being able to have those English speakers be more proficient and be more biliterate and more bilingual when they exit Pacheco. I think it would just benefit them even more. So, I mean, the research is out there, but I think it's the integration issue is paramount. I think that they're together all the time. so that they can have those relationships and those experiences together, so that it's not this group and that group. It's us together as students. So thank you very much. You all look like great little kindergartners up there, and I appreciate your patience.
Mr. Unger.
So my question, thank you for everybody for coming in. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you called on me.
I did call on you.
Oh.
I'll be translating this evening for you. I'm like a parent in this program.
It's okay.
Pienso que la propuesta, I'm so excited because it's a good proposal for the Mr. Mayfield, and it's a good program for the kids, and me gustaría que aceptaran la propuesta.
I would really appreciate if you accepted this proposal.
Pienso que España es un país donde el inglés domina, pero es también muy importante cuando la gente tiene varios idiomas.
This is a country where English is the dominant language, but it's very important to have people knowing two languages.
Because tienen más oportunidades respecto académicamente como laboral en el trabajo. Mejor posición de trabajo y mejor posición en el estudio.
They have wonderful opportunities, be it education or the way that they can take a job. They can do better in school, and they can progress better in their lives.
Y me gusta la propuesta porque yo no tuve estudios y quiero que mi hijo sea alguien con un buen estudio y que tenga muchas oportunidades en la vida.
I did not have the opportunity to have an education, but I want my son to have all that opportunity and to be able to reach many things in his academic career and go farther than I ever did.
Okay. Gracias.
Gracias a tu. Mr. Unger.
So this is listed as a discussion item, and I'm wondering what sort of, are you looking for direction from the board? Are you looking for a motion from the board? What specifically would you like to have come out of this from us?
Well, I appreciate that. As Mr. Mayfield mentioned, when he first got up to the podium, he mentioned, gosh, I wish we could have gotten in front of the board back in the fall. We have been, as you know, we've had a very busy school year. There's been a lot of whole lot of things we've been taking on, and so Mr. Mayfield just quietly kept doing what he was doing, and he spoke to his community, he spoke to his staff, and as our communities are very integrated and small, we hear things. So I thought it was wise that we get this topic in front of the board. I feel that it's, while you've heard for yourselves what this program might offer, this transition might offer, I feel uncomfortable and why it's not an action item this evening. My thought is that maybe you could revisit this on the 31st. That would give you some time to research this on your own, to ask questions, to contact Mr. Mayfield, ask questions to myself about some of the implications of this, and then I could bring it back on the 31st for discussion and perhaps action.
Will you bring it back with an administrative recommendation?
Yes, Mrs. Roger.
Thank you.
I'd prefer to wait as well and have a little more time to think about it, but it's
So 2 weeks, I could bring back a recommendation in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Yes. Can we get a 5-10 minutes? Mr. Strong, we'll take a 5-minute break. presentation? Okay. I know. Okay, next we're at item 8.03, Leveled Literacy Intervention Review.
All right, so much for our plan to do like four little 10-minute presentations tonight. We're on number three and 2 hours later. Tonight you have, I'm doing fill-in for Amy Shields, and I'm sure she would be a far better explainer of our leveled literacy intervention program. But last board meeting, we got to hear about one of our most powerful interventions, reading recovery. And I think it's important for the board and the public to realize that there are many things we do in terms of intervention and trying to help our most needy students, especially in the area of English language arts. One of those is what you've heard. We've thrown the term around a lot, LLI, Leveled Literacy Intervention. And so I wanted to just present a little bit about that program because it has pretty important effects also. So first of all, reading recovery is a very targeted intervention for first grade only students. As you heard the last, there were 60 students affected by that program in our school district. LLI, as of right now, we've had 520 students involved in that. So it represents about 15% of our elementary population. We have LLI in place at all of our elementary schools except for Teach Elementary, where it doesn't seem to be an issue or needed, but we have LLI groups running at all of our schools. On the bottom graph, you can kind of see that it is really targeted at all grade levels, but as with all really good reading interventions, you want to use these most effectively at the earliest possible grade level. Kindergarten students aren't targeted into LLI until about halfway through the school year. It wouldn't be appropriate at the beginning of the school year. But it is something that is primarily used in the first and second grade periods. We have a lot of teachers trained now. 40 staff members are trained in how to facilitate LLI groups. And it's quite the range of people. So we have classroom teachers, special ed teachers, kindergarten teachers who might run LLI groups in the afternoon, TK teachers, retired people come back and run LLI groups. There's one of our instructional coaches, because our coaches also run LLI groups. That's Grace Washer at Bishop's Peak, working with a group of students. LLI is actually a program where typically you're going to have two to five students in a group as opposed to one-on-one instruction. There is another one of our teachers, that's Cindy Dixon at Baywood, working with an upper grade group of students. And that's a pretty typical size group, five students. It's important to know that just as with reading recovery, writing is a component of LLI. Students write about what they are reading every other day within those LLI groups. If you go into many of our book rooms in our schools, you will find all these color-coded shelves because LLI materials are leveled by grade level, and so each color represents a different grade level. But to really do justice, I'm going to show just this little video about kind of LLI in action and then ask one of our elementary principals who has a lot of experience in this to come fill you in a bit about how it's working at one of our schools. So, Mrs. Holmes, if you just click that one, we'll see one of our instructional coaches and some students working through some LLI issues.
Watch as instructional coach Laura Spearing begins the lesson by having students reread books, listening for fluency and understanding.
This unfamiliar road. And although this way.
Can I hear you say Chris?
Chris Cross.
Mm-hmm.
Every lesson includes targeted phonics or word work. Today, Laura is working with students, breaking apart difficult words, looking for meaning, and finding prefixes.
What did I underline?
What's that word?
Nation.
Nation.
That's the root word. So they changed nation into national. Okay? So that means it's across the nation, across the country. This is the prefix now.
Inter.
Inter. International. Hmm. What could inter mean? So national means it's across one country. What do you think international might mean? Can you think of another word that has inter in it? Or at the beginning of it, Sydney?
Introduce.
Hmm. That sounds the same. That's partly how we pronounce it.
After Laura has introduced a new book, students read for understanding and prepare to use the text to demonstrate comprehension. Text features are taught and reinforced.
Think about the different features that the author included in this book when she chose to write it. What did she include to help explain the sport? Or what did she do with this book to really help you understand what Double Dutch is? Taylor?
On the page, she showed like 5 or 3 steps to show how to do it.
Can you show me? So I hear you saying she listed some steps. So that helped us understand it. That made it really clear, didn't it? Mm-hmm. On page 10. Mm-hmm. So okay. 3 rounds of tricks, and it's explaining round 1 and all of the steps. What else did she do to help us really understand Double Dutch?
Page 10, mm-hmm. And page 13, like 12, mm-hmm. says round 2.
Okay.
Then 10, it says round 1, 3 rounds of tricks. Mm.
So you're pointing out the headings that she used. That helped us understand it. Parker?
Captions.
Captions helped us. Sydney? Oh, you were going to say captions too? Can you think of anything else?
That she uses the pictures so you see what they're doing.
Yeah, that really helps. Because if you just hear these steps, I mean...
Additional word work is taught and practiced as part of the lesson. Here, Laura works on consonant clusters with the students.
All 3 of them?
Yep.
Allenge. Okay.
Kurein.
Say it again.
Kurein.
Thank you. Nice job. One from here. So that you have 3 words, and then you pick your own 3 words. I want you to pause. Pick a word from here. Word from here. Word from here.
And finally, let's hear what Laura has to say about adjusting her teaching to meet students' needs.
So I've had to go back with this group because 3 kids are new. 3 of the 5 are brand new. And the 2 who have been with me, they have this down because we've done so much word work, and we actually worked through the end of the 2nd grade kit. And so when we switched over to the 3rd grade kit, there's less word work, and these 3rd graders need that word work. So I'm continuing on with the books from the 3rd grade kit, but I've gone back to the blue 2nd grade kit, and I've been printing some of the word work activities. So I knew they were behind with that, but as soon as I started and even my 2 couldn't give me the exact definition of a consonant cluster, I thought, oh, I need to go back even another step. So I slowed it down and focused on that.
As I said, we've over the last 3 years, we've expanded LLI through our school district, and as part of our LCAP last year, we added funds to augment. We were doing it at our Title I schools largely, but we augmented funding so that we can have more LLI groups throughout the school district. And I'd like to have Jeff Martin, principal of Sensheimer, come up and share a little insights as to how that's worked at one of our non-Title I schools.
So you got a good overview there of what LLI looks like, and my hope is to be able to just provide some facts for you about what it looks like at Sensheimer and hopefully fill in any gaps that you have in your understanding and leave some time for questions. So As Rick said, Sinsheimer's a non-Title I school, albeit very, very close to being a Title I school. We have students who are not yet reading at a proficient level. And LLI has been fantastic for us. We have two LLI teachers at our site. One, who, they're both doing a fantastic job, by the way. One, Sonia, works 5 days a week, 4 hours a day, and she is an hourly paid teacher. And the other teacher is doing reading recovery at our site, but picks up an extra hour to work with students in level literacy intervention. And so we have two teachers, and between those two teachers, they are able to serve between 45 and 50 students throughout, we anticipate, throughout this school year. So that's tremendous when you look at the number of students that we're able to serve. And much like the rest of the district, those students are primarily in the primary grades, kinder, first, and second. We do have a couple of upper grade students. But when you look at what we are able to provide for our students, it really is a fantastic intervention. So a little bit, maybe if I can give you a little bit of a picture about the budget. Because as a non-Title I school, we have to be very particular about our resources and make sure that we're putting them to good use. And a bulk of our site budget is actually spent on LLI for our students. We believe in that early reading intervention, and we've seen good results from it. So we have, thankfully, we got some support from the district. Thank you, Ryan, for and others for taking a look. And yeah, the board actually. Absolutely. Of course, we know you approve the use of those funds and recognizing that that early intervention is important. So that $10,000 that came to Sinsheimer was put to very good use. We actually supplemented that as well with an additional like $17,000 to $18,000. So when you look at it in total, between those that $28,000, we're actually able to have about 135 days of reading intervention that serves between, like I said, 45 and 50 students. And it's been really powerful. Just like I said, again, with Sonia and Michelle both working, they each have different numbers of students, but I want to give you a little glimpse of, or kind of a little, some information behind the scenes. As far as the number of groups that we have, basically at any given time, we'll have seven groups of students. They're between three and four. This group was five students, so it's a fairly small group that they're working with at any given time, and they're working with materials that, as was mentioned, are organized by grade level. And students, it's a fluid thing, so we'll have basically three sessions throughout the year where we can move students in or out of those groups depending on how much they're progressing. So if they're making good progress and they've met their reading benchmark, they will be exited, because that may be all they need, is that little bit of extra time and support to come back up to the benchmark, and they're exited and back into the classroom where they're continuing to receive that support. Other students may be in more than one session over a period of years, and so that also is important because it tells us that this child, there may be something else going on that we need to find out more. So we may, if they're not responding to that intervention, then we might want to move forward with an assessment to determine if they're maybe struggling with a specific learning disability or there's something else interfering with their ability to access that curriculum and that instruction. So it's an important intervention from that standpoint, too. A little bit just about the logistics. We actually hire our teachers. Like I said, it was 135 days of instruction. Typically, we wait until about the first month of school when we have a better handle on our students and who might be best placed in those groups. And so as far as the LLI teachers, like I said, those 135 days is basically the whole school year with the exception of the first month and the last month of the school year. And we're pretty strategic about the number of days that we, and when we have those, like, you know, obviously the certain calendar days during the year that we don't have them working for different reasons. Again, just I think for us, looking at Sinsheimer, we have a fairly big population of students who need that extra time and support, and LLI has been fantastic for us to be able to provide that on when we look at our limited resources. Reading recovery is fantastic, and it does, it's that very, very targeted intervention, serving a very few number of students. But that LLI piece is that kind of that second tier that's really been able to cover a lot of students. And I have some, you know, we've shown some tremendous results over the years. So any questions? Be happy to take any questions.
First, we'll see if anyone from the public wishes to speak to this item. Seeing no one, Mr. Millar.
Can you give me a sense of, during that first month of school, what assessments are the teachers making to determine the literacy level?
Yeah, we do what's called a benchmark assessment in reading. So during that first month, especially in the primary grades, they're really sitting down one-on-one with the teachers, with the students, excuse me, the teachers sitting down with their own children or their own students and doing those assessments so that we have an idea of every student in the class and what level they're reading at. And the kindergarten students, they're doing that, but we give them a little bit of time and we'll actually start serving our kindergarten students midway through the school year once we get a better handle on them as learners.
So do you serve K through 6?
We do. Since I'm right now, we don't have any 5th or 6th graders. But we do. We could.
If you did.
Yeah.
You
yeah. It's a K-6 program.
Okay. Yeah. And does the teacher who works at Sinsheimer, does she only work at Sinsheimer as far as you know?
We have the two. One is teaching reading recovery, and she picks up an extra hour of LLI.
Oh, I see.
And then our other teacher, Sonia, is just an hourly teacher.
Right.
And she's just doing 4 hours of LLI a day.
I see.
With a little bit of prep time in there.
Right.
But she serves 6 groups of students.
Okay.
Yeah, during each day.
And most of our teachers are dedicated to one school. We, like I said, we have 40 people now trained in LLI. They're all credentialed teachers, so it's not a program run by aides or you know, paraprofessionals. They're credentialed teachers, but it's slightly different at every school, and most of the teachers are dedicated to that one school, so there's some flexibility in their schedule.
Okay, thank you. That was my next question. Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, reading recovery, if I remember correctly, reaches the lowest 10% of students in the first grade.
Correct.
That's the group we pull for reading recovery. And then what group of students would LLI, if a student was a struggling reader but didn't qualify for reading recovery, then would it be what next group of students?
Right. We try to target all of those students who really are, in the primary grades, reading below the benchmark level. Those who are furthest below that benchmark level will be served first. And it oftentimes works where those first graders who are getting a reading recovery will float back into an LLI group afterward.
After they exit reading recovery.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and how many times a week is reading recovery? The children go 5 days a week?
That's right.
Yeah. And for LLI?
It depends. I know each site might be a little different. Last year we did 4 days a week. This year we're doing 5 days a week.
Okay. I think those were my questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Quisenberry.
So have you had the advantage of any of the volunteers? I thought I read in, were they trained volunteers or were they paid volunteers? I mean, they're all paid volunteers. So there's a cost associated no matter. There's no volunteers that are doing it for gratis, for free. So, okay.
At Sinsheimer.
Not at Sinsheimer. And not anywhere in the district.
No.
Okay. But they may be a little lower cost or no?
What's a pardon?
Is the cost lower? I mean, because yes, they might be paying at a different rate.
They are. Actually, yeah. In with the related cost of personnel, we're paying between $36 and $40 in total per hour.
Okay.
And so, like I said, when you look at the total number, the amount of time and the number of students we're serving with that $28,000, I think that money's being put to really good use.
Well spent. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I would add that this is, you know, we have a reading expert in our school district, Mary Zerm, and she trains the LLI teachers also. This is a part of that LLI continuum, that reading continuum, I should say, for our students.
So what you're telling us is that children benefiting from LLI have the opportunity to move in and out of the program as needed over a period of time, could be over several years. So receiving interventions over time where reading recovery is first grade only and the lowest 10%. I had the opportunity to watch an LLI lesson a couple of years ago. Very impressive. But I think that one or two students was absent that day, so it was just three children there.
Our groups are three.
Yours are three?
Four students, but we stick with the model which is really designed for three students.
It was close to individualized.
Yeah.
I mean, although there were three children there, they were getting very direct attention from instruction from the teacher.
Even within that group of three, you're going to have that targeted support and instruction. Yeah.
So at our schools across the district, Mr. Robinette, do we sometimes go up to five students in an LLI group?
Yes, we do.
But not above five?
I don't think we have any example above five that I've seen. I think it's designed for three. Mm-hmm. I see three, four, an absent student, maybe a couple, but I think it's by design. It's intended for very small groups so there can be a lot of individualization.
And so students, one of the major benefits of LLI would be that a student can continue to benefit from that pull-out instruction over first, second, third, fourth grade, if necessary, going in and out of the program as needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we don't typically see that. I mean, if we're providing this intervention and it's that targeted support and they're not successful in closing that gap,
right,
then that tells us that we need to do something different. And typically what that means is that we'll move towards assessment, possibly,
right,
to find out if there's something else that's interfering with this child's ability to progress and close that gap.
Great. Thank you very much.
And I think it's important to know that, like any good reading intervention, it's best given at the earliest mm-hmm. opportune time. That's why it's really intended for those primary first and second grade students. When we have a fourth and fifth grade group, it may be because we have new students in the school district that have struggled with reading and are just newly identified, like, wow, we need to do something here. But we know that one of the greatest predictors of later high school success is the ability to read at the end of first grade. And so just with reading recovery, we are trying to target, primary students with this intervention.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Mrs. Sheffer, I think it also should be noted that this is also an effective model to minimize assessments as well, or to really refine the number of kids that get assessed for special education mm-hmm. services. Mm-hmm. And so having that continuum through the early grades up through fourth, fifth grade really does give us a longer view and can really help really narrow the number of students that qualify or at least get assessed for special education.
Thank you. Look, it's you again.
It's me again. So the continuing saga of A through G and CTE. I'm here for report number three here. Thank you, Mrs. Holmes. So this is part three of a discussion about a couple board interests and what I heard, and I probably haven't captured them exactly the way they were shared originally when the board said, future agenda item, can we look at this, was really, should we alter graduation requirements? Should we have more students graduating A through G ready? That was one of the questions, one of the concerns I heard. Another one was, should we alter graduation requirements to give more flexibility with regard to CTE courses, or should we encourage more CTE courses even in the A through G area? And as you know, a month or so ago at the first meeting, I decided to kind of talk about A through G, so at least we have a common understanding that there are seven different areas that are covered, A, B, C, D through G, that these are universal now, that they're a part of both the UC and the CSU system as of the last 15 or so years, and that students not only have to take these courses and They have to pass them with a grade of C or better. In fact, they have to have a 3.0 grade point average to qualify, but the minimum standard is a C. You can't get a D or an F in those classes and be A through G ready. At the last meeting, I talked about the evolution of CTE and how really, I think, thankfully, finally, we've come to a much better understanding that we're really not trying to track students into two different tracks, either being kind of career-ready or college-ready, but we want students to be both career and college-ready, and it's really an exciting evolution for us. Tonight, I just wanted to share some other related info to those questions and actually make a recommendation for you for the future. So the first thing is, you know, I heard at the last board meeting some discussion about rigor and why is it that we don't have more students graduate A through G? Why is it that, you know, we're in that 50-60% of our students actually graduating from our high schools but not able to go right into a four-year university? I can't give you the exact statistics, but as I uncovered things, I realized that it's really not because of access to classes. Almost all of our classes are college preparatory. All of our English classes are college preparatory. All of our social science classes, with the exception of the ninth grade, which is not college preparatory and not required, are A through G classes. All of our math classes are college preparatory. All of our science classes are A through G. In fact, 44% of our electives are A through G. Most of the things that any student takes in their high school program is A through G. So it's really not because of access. However, there are certain classes that are not, and that really is part of the second group. EL students and special education students, which make up 20% of our high school population, currently that's about what our high school population is, 20% EL and special ed combined, very well may not be in A through G classes because of the nature of their needs. And so our EL English classes, for example, with the exception of the one you approved two meetings ago, I think it was, and that we are moving forward, but that's an EL level 3 English class. They largely are not and will not be considered college preparatory. So if a student is an English learner and needs that support of an EL class, by definition, they're not getting A through G access. Many of our special education students, in fact, most, are probably in one or more resource classes or might be in a special day class. Those classes are not A through G and will not qualify for A through G. And so there are a certain percentage of our population that will be excluded from this by the nature of either their language ability or a special education issue. We do have, I was actually pleasantly surprised by this number, about 18%, but only about 18% of our students not taking 2 years of foreign language. So that means 82% of our kids actually do take foreign language. I thought that was one of the reasons, and it is one of the reasons that students don't graduate A through G ready, but most students are taking 2 years of foreign language. And again, some of that 18% may be special education students or EL students that might not be appropriate in a foreign language class, although many of our EL students do quite well in Spanish. The overarching or overriding issue actually is grades. It's not access to classes or the types of courses that students take. It's the grades they get in those classes. And so you can imagine a student who might struggle in middle school, get into their first year in ninth grade, and receive a D in English in the first semester. By definition, that student is no longer A through G ready to go to college 3 or 4 years later, unless they do something to remediate that D, in other words, retake that class, which is difficult to do, and in a college preparatory environment. They may retake it through what we used to do through adult education, we now do at the high school itself, through an A-plus program or an online program that isn't A through G. And so that is a problem. And so I think for the board to consider requiring A through G, we would also have to think through remediation and think through grades, because students must have a C. They can't get a D or an F and be qualified. So that's just this one, that's, as we explore that issue of what we want to require, it's one of those things that we have to also look at, is what are we going to do about grades and students not making that C average? Are we going to change our expectations about what constitutes passing? Because right now a D gets full credit for a class and it's passing the class, even though obviously it is at a below average level. With regard to CTE, I just wanted to bring up a few things that I didn't mention last time. And one, I think I did mention it, is that we can and should increase the number of CTE courses that qualify for A through G. Many probably cannot be and will not be, but it's something we should constantly be looking at, and we are. And so I think that's important that we continue to look at that, because it just provides more access for students. I do want to mention that we are part of the first round and are actually be applying for a second round of something called the California Career Pathways Trust Grant. This is a grant that we are in collaboration with Cuesta College and the business community. So we're part of a consortium. We have a couple of our teachers that have been a big part of this, Liz Moore and Jan Fetcho. Liz at Morro Bay High School and Jan Fetcho at Slo High School. And our pathway has to do with computer science and information communication technology, so kind of the geeky side of computers, and I say that lovingly, the computer science portion, but also the digital media, artistic, creative side of information technology. So we have an advisory committee with business partners in place. We will be developing new courses, and it just seems like the right pathway for our school district to kind of focus on the computing and digital media realm. That's what we're taking on. We also have an exciting opportunity here. This will be our first foray into something called dual credit courses. We have had concurrent enrollment with our community college forever. So a student can go to the high school and go to Cuesta College at the same time and complete graduation requirements, but they're concurrently enrolled. They're enrolled at two places at one time, getting credit at one of the other places. This is popular in some other states, but we are entering into an agreement to start some dual credit opportunities, and I think this is going to be really good, especially in the CTE areas. We'll be starting with automotives, largely, at Slo High School, and perhaps drafting. And the whole idea of dual credit, if you think of advanced placement, the idea behind advanced placement is you take a high school class taught by a high school teacher, but at the end of the course, you take an exam. And if you pass the exam at a certain level, a 3, 4, or 5, depending on the college or university you go to, you get college credit. So you're getting high school credit, but at the same time, you're accumulating the possibility, anyway, of college credits. I'm a great example of that. I got through college in 3.5 years, not because of brains, but because I had these AP credits that, you know, enabled me to get through school faster. Well, dual credit works the same way with the community college. The idea is we teach a course at our high school taught by one of our teachers, but it's really a college course. It's the same course you would take at Cuesta. It's just taught at the high school. We use the college's materials, but it's a high school course. So our courses have to really be aligned. That's why they only work for certain courses. But the idea is the student would get their high school credit for it, but they're also getting college credit for it. They're actually getting credit in two different institutions that they can take with them. So dual credit in the state of Washington has been the way some students graduate from high school and actually have most of their AA completed. We're not anywhere close to that, but we're starting on that path. There's a lot of details to work out, especially in terms of coordinated curriculum, so we'll be bringing the board more information about that. So with regard to next steps, I feel inadequate to give you a recommendation of what you should do with graduation requirements with all this stuff. My recommendation is that you get more information from other experts, because I don't have the expertise in this. I think about the way Congress operates. They often have congressional hearings. Their study sessions are hearings. And so you, as the legislative body, I think it would be very wise for you to get some experts. And we have experts in our midst. Our counselors have a lot of expertise in these areas, our high school counselors, and would be able to probably give some testimony, as you would in a congressional hearing, and answer questions from the board, from the public, about what they perceive. We have teachers who would probably have some opinions on the matter of graduation requirements and CTE and direction. We have experts in our community. You know, Ken Sanfilippo was sitting in our audience last week. You know, Ken's my go-to guy with anything CTE. He ran one of the largest ROPs in the state and became an ROP superintendent after he left us and has a lot of knowledge and lives in our backyard. There may be, college counselors or admissions counselors or somebody from the regents of the UC or CSU that could come give the board advice on what they're seeing in terms of, just testimony. And so I would recommend, as opposed to making an adjustment to what you believe is your board policy or changing graduation requirements, is to have the opportunity to hear from other people and schedule a study session, maybe talk about it at your summer retreat or schedule it into the fall, so that if we are going to consider any changes to our policy or direction, we do it early enough in the school year next year that we can make those implementations for the year following. But that's my suggestion. And with that, I'll throw it back to the board.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to address us on this issue? Okay, seeing no one. A couple things I'd like to raise. It also sounds like you mentioned with not passing, the grades being a problem. And I would also indicate that I think that if a student fails a particular class, and even if the opportunity is there to retake it, then that precludes that student from taking
other classes.
Yeah, and so that becomes a real sort of, could be kind of a death spiral for continuing in this. And a couple things I raised before, I just want to reiterate, I guess. So one was having to do with some of these, seeing if we, and again, I appreciate your comments about speaking with others and perhaps having a study session, and I don't want this to go off the radar, so we'll continue to work with educating ourselves, as you suggested. But having some summer school available, perhaps, that is on the front end instead of at the back end, to sort of, prepare kids for an English class, looking at their history, being able to recommend that, you might want to take English this summer, this particular class, before you take this class to ensure success or to to raise the chances for success in classes coming up. Now, I know that in some ways would be changing our philosophy about summer school, but that's something that, as one person, I believe is worthwhile to look into.
And if I can just make one comment, I know you have something else to that. That's what we've tried to do this last year, and we'll be continuing it again this year. I mean, not exactly what you're suggesting, but we're calling it our bridge program, both from sixth grade to seventh grade, or at the coast, fifth grade to sixth grade, and then eighth grade and ninth grade at both schools. It's just kind of truly targeting 20 or so of our most at-risk kids and saying, now before you go to high school, here's a summer school class for you to take, just about managing homework and rigor and what to expect. And we did that last year, and we will continue it again this year. I don't know if it gets to all those issues, but and I honestly don't know if we tracked those students to see if it worked. I mean, we probably should look at the data. But that's the idea, is kind of give students a little head start of being on the campus, understanding what the expectations are going to be.
Yeah,
could be helpful.
And perhaps in particular subject matters. I mean, it just seems so much better for the student to experience success after having been given a little leg up than failing and then feeling they have to, the student needs to start over, or, why bother? It just complicates things so much. So something to explore. And then again, just reiterating that I think that I love hearing about the CTE classes that are A through G. I think our kids who perhaps high school will be the end of their educational career. They deserve the best, most rigor and the best we have to offer. So having said that, Ms. Eisenbeth Rogers and Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. So I was thinking along the same lines as Mrs. Sheffer, and just that it seems almost that we're talking about a reading recovery program. This is more like an A through G recovery program. Mm-hmm. You know, that could be summer or maybe even online. Is online a possibility?
It is a possibility, and that's one thing I think we probably could explore, is that right now the most accessible online program for credit recovery is not A through G approved. So students who failed a class, we plug them into a credit recovery online program. They can get the credits, but they're not getting A through G credits. They're getting credits for the class, credits to graduate. And there are certainly programs out there, online programs. There's something called the UC Scout program, which is actually Common Core aligned A through G courses. They're hard, but they cost money. They're not free for the student or for us. But that might be something for us to explore—an alternative way to make up credits or to get ahead of the credits. But it certainly, in this case, to make up credits through an online avenue—that's something we could explore.
And then just one point of clarification. You indicated that we as a board could decide whether a D would be a passing grade in A through G. Is that what you were saying to us?
We couldn't decide that. You have to get a C or better to be qualified for A through G. What I meant is, if you're going to look at requiring students to be A through G in order to graduate from high school, we probably have to rethink our high school graduation requirements, which now allow students who get Ds to graduate from high school. I think if the question was, should we require A through G as an exit from our high school program, the implications aren't just the courses they're taking, and it would be what kinds of grades are we requiring students to get in order to graduate. And currently, we allow students to graduate with Ds.
And CSU and UCs do not accept a D, right?
Not unless it's made up. Not unless it's made up. And you know, they're looking for a 3.0 grade point average anyway, so it's very difficult to get into competitive schools with Ds.
Thank you.
Mr. Thank
you. Walter, did you have something you wanted to say? I can give the floor to you. You were
no, Marco. We just were talking about.
Okay. It, sure. Rick, as we talk about the A to Gs, one of the things I need to, because when I've looked into this a little bit, there's what qualifies you for the state UC CSU system.
Right.
Right? And we've got, 80, what percent of our students are going to Cuesta?
I don't recall.
But it's a
lot.
A lot. The majority.
The majority.
So what I'm thinking is, as we focus on the A to Gs, there's also, I don't know how many colleges and universities in the United States, but we don't seem to send a lot of kids outside of the state of California.
No.
I'm
small
sorry,
percentage.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether counselors, I don't know whether that's something to look into as well, because A to G is not necessarily needed to go, you know, to Colby or some school on the East Coast.
Well, it's not needed to go to. This is just for UCs or CSUs. There are lots of colleges in California.
Yeah, that's the point. Thanks.
You would need.
Yeah, that was the point I'm trying to make. Thanks, Ellen. I appreciate that.
I thought you were saying they needed to go out of state. So
no, exactly the opposite. And so I'm just really hoping that we don't lose sight of that as well. We have a lot of kids here that do really well. They may not meet the A to Gs, and they can go, on to some great schools.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Yes.
Rick, one of my kids, and I can't remember which one it was now.
Well, they're both brilliant.
they're both brilliant. Well, one of my brilliant children took summer school, and I believe it was for credit recovery, mm-hmm. and it was Bob Schwanoa, so I think it must have been
math.
And it was offered at Los Osos Middle School, though they were a high school student. And I think that recovery allowed them still to be a qualifier
yes.
for A through G.
Yes.
Is that no longer an option?
No, that's absolutely an option. So if a student who takes algebra in summer school, they're getting A through G credit for that class, either as makeup credit or original credit.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
So I leave it up to you to decide what to do further with this. I don't have a recommendation on changing the graduation requirements at this time. I think you should study it.
I agree. Thank you. Thanks very much. That was a really good clarification. I did already. Yes. Okay. 8.05, Measure D.
Hey, let's build a pool. So Mr. Plaza was here to talk about kind of moving forward with the pool process. As I said earlier, the school side and the site committee, which you're going to learn a lot more about on Friday, is going through this whole process with the whole campus and everything they're doing and budget and how it all lays out. But the pool project at Morro Bay, because of what's happening at Cuesta, because of the lack of a facility, this is why we're here today to kind of that particular project move it forward. So Anthony's going to kind of talk about, the next step with these two contracts.
Okay. Thank you, Ryan. So what we have is two contracts in front of you today. The first is for Mano Construction. And what this is for is what we consider the pre-construction services agreement to potentially enter into a lease-leaseback construction delivery method to build the pool. This is pretty typical in most lease-leaseback delivery methods in that you bring the contractor on board early on in the design process. They're part of the team that's helping making decisions on methods of building, types of building, models, phasing, and any kind of make-ready work that we can do potentially ahead of the actual construction starting, maybe even this summer or early in the fall, to expedite the construction process every way we can. At the same time, they're looking at the project from a constructability standpoint. Can it be built? How can we build it? And making sure that the drawings are of a good quality, high quality, as a second set of eyes. And then the third kind of component of their contract is to provide some preliminary pricing. They go out, they start to price things, they start to put quantities together, they start to actually reach out to some of the subcontractors to get a sense of what the project is going to cost as a whole to make sure that the independent cost estimate being done by the architecture team is in alignment with the budgets and the bids that we're actually getting from the contractor, and where there is discrepancies, we can sort of tease those out and have a discussion about them and make sure we've got, that we're moving in a good direction from the budget and scope standpoint. So this is kind of the first one that we're doing in terms of this formalized pre-construction services agreement. This doesn't lock us into using Mano. As you saw in the contract, it's there's a fee if we decide to not use them, or the project is canceled, or for whatever reason that we don't move forward. And if we do move forward, then the cost of this gets rolled into the construction cost. So having said that, we recommend approval for Mano Construction on this project only for a pre-construction services agreement, with the hope of moving forward in the future on building this pool. Now, as we'll talk about on Friday, possibly a little bit, we're likely going to bring in a future board meeting, a potential of an RFQ that would put together a pool of contractors at a later date to start to move forward with other projects if we decided to move in the lease-leaseback arrangement for them. But there isn't actually an ed code or a legal requirement to do an RFQ. It's a best practice. And so given the timeline, given the tight constraints we're under to get this thing going, and Mano's experience with building pools in sandy soil, we decided that this was probably a very good, and they're local as well, good method of moving forward on this particular project.
Okay.
Okay, and then I'll go ahead and jump in on KBC.
Well, let me ask you this. Will we approve these contracts one at a time? Because if so, maybe we should discuss them one at a time, if that's all right with everybody. Mm-hmm. It'd be clearer for me.
Sure.
So having said that, is there anyone from the public who would like to discuss the Mano contract? All right.
I tend to really draw a crowd, don't I?
You do. They're all at home, you know, in their pajamas with a cup of coffee. Just
watching with bated breath.
That's right. Okay, Mr. Quisenberry.
If there's no further comment, I'll move approval.
Well, I didn't know we were there yet, so.
Oh, okay. Then I'll wait.
All right. Okay. I just have a pretty obvious question, which is you said that's what Mano does. They build pools. Any pools that we might have actually set foot in?
It's not all they do, but they've had some local experience. I believe it was the Rigetti Pool in Santa Maria that they had most recently built, and that had a sandy soil condition. In fact, in early discussions with them, we've already talked about some of the things we can potentially do this summer to kind of remediate any sand issues that we have out there, kind of get that site prepared before we actually move into final construction, so that we can do that early and up front. Just to get ready and be that much farther ahead when we get started potentially early next year. So that's probably the closest pool you could go see that they've constructed.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else?
I have a question.
Mr. Millar.
Excuse me. Who drafts our agreements?
This is the model year 2015 pre-construction services agreement from Lozano Smith.
Excellent. That's kind of where I was hoping.
Okay.
Our lawyers, so, rather than their lawyers.
Right.
Mrs. Roger.
Hi. I just had a quick question. It pertains to both, I believe. It pertains to one or the other, Mano or KBZ, because in reading through the contracts, I can't remember which one I was reading now, where they were talking about the possible interfaces that I think it was KBZ. The interfaces that they would have with various regulatory agencies and what have you. And I didn't see the city of Morro Bay specifically outlined, spelled out in the contract. I think it's probably assumed that they would be interfacing with the city of Morro Bay, and I just want to make sure that that is covered, because in the distant past we had some difficulties having to do with the well at Morro Bay, and so we need to make sure that we have someone on board that will have a good, established good rapport with the city of Morro Bay.
That's a very good question. So KBZ will be responsible for coordinating with the city of Morro Bay for utility connections and sewage connections and all of those type of connections. And I believe it'll probably say utility coordination in there. It won't specifically call out the city of Morro Bay, because in some, you know, it's a template contract, so in some jurisdictions that may be a separate water district. Now, in terms of the other component of the city of Morro Bay with the coastal development permit, we've actually hired Firma to do that as a separate contract, and that's very typical that an architect wouldn't handle necessarily that coastal development permit. You may hire an environmental firm with expertise in that, which we've done in this case, to handle that city of Morro Bay coastal development permit component. So those are the two kind of simultaneous pieces. The utility coordination would be the piece that where we'd move. We'd work with City of Morro Bay through KBZ. The coastal development permit through the City of Morro Bay is being handled by Firma Consultants. Okay?
We are also closely linked with the City of Morro Bay, too.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of talking to the city, talking to the city manager, I mean, all of the plans, everything we're doing, really tying in with the city. So it's, I mean, those are the conversations that are happening outside of maybe this contract part of it, but just so that you know, we...
Right.
Yeah, I just wasn't privy to anything that went on with around the issue of the well, but I know that it was sort of a drawn-out process, and there was a lot of interface with the city required to make it come to fruition. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, typically in these pools, it's not the water coming in that's the issue, it's the water going out that's the issue. We're lucky we have a very close treatment facility, you know, near the site, so, and we're down at the bottom end of it, so we've got the biggest pipe we can probably have out there in the street. So it
works well for us.
I think it's going to work out.
Okay.
I'm crossing my fingers.
Then do we have a motion?
Well, I'd like to take it back to Mr. Quisenberry, since he made an attempt before. So
I will second his motion.
So we're taking each contract separately. Yes. So I move the approval of the Mano contract for the Morro Bay pool.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. You got yourself a contract.
Okay. You guys can put your hats on. We're in the construction business.
All right.
Actually, technically, we're still in the professional services business still.
Yeah. Ground has not been broken. Okay.
So the next contract is actually a contract amendment. This is with KBZ Architects. As you're aware, we did enter into an agreement with them earlier this year to provide the schematic design services for our pool template at both sites, as well as for the specific schematic design services for the pool at Morro Bay High School. At the time, we were kind of really trying to scope that out. We weren't sure what that pool was really going to look like. We were starting to work on the bigger planning components, so we only entered into an agreement with schematic design services for them. This contract amendment carries it through the completion of construction. So it's a design development through the construction administration phases and all the phases in between there as a full architect package now to get DSA approval, local agency approvals, and the final administration of the construction contract. So this is basically the language that the sections 5.4 through 5.7, I believe it was, that were cut out of the original contract where you only had the schematic design section. This now adds those sections back in. The fees that you're seeing are based on the state OPSC's standard sliding scale that we've seen over the years, with the additional services that aren't typically part of that sliding scale outlined below. We're kind of starting to develop that template Exhibit A sheet that you've seen. You'll see that kind of morph over the next couple contracts as we kind of get that information a little more refined and get it working a little better for us. But just trying to kind of put a tool together for you guys to be able to see the fees and how they're developed in a very simple manner. I hope that actually helps. And it actually makes our contracts team expedite putting the contracts together much. It expedites it for them to kind of just have all that data in one spot. They can just cut and paste and put the data in. So with that, we recommend approval of the contract for KBZ. And if there's any questions from the public or the board, I'm happy to answer.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to this? All right, Mrs. Roger.
Well, I only allowed Mr. Millar and Mr. Questenberry to move the Mano contract because I wanted the big one for myself. So I'll move approval of the KBZ Morro Bay High School pool contract number 15-104.
Any further discussion?
That's what I see.
We have a second?
Well, I was going to second, but since it's on the coast, okay, I'll second it.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, you've got yourself two contracts.
Okay. We've all got ourselves some contracts. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. We are on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like any of these items pulled.
Madam President?
Yes, sir.
I don't want any of these items pulled, and I have to recuse myself on the purchase order, so I thought I would just bid adieu.
Oh, adieu. You're leaving us with a bare minimum quorum.
A strong bare minimum.
That's right. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, I could stick around, but...
You'd have to go stand out in the cold and everything.
You have to go to the far end of the school district.
You do. Okay, 9.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items.
Pull.
9.02, disposition of surplus property. 9.03, acceptance of donations. 9.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 9.05, approval of purchase orders. 9.06, approval to pay board member's salary for permissible absence. All right, I would seek a motion to approve items 9.02 through 9.06.
I so move.
Is there a second? All right.
I second it.
Anyone from the public want to talk about our action consent agenda? Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, Mr. Quisenberry, 9.01.
Yes, I'm surprised that Marilyn didn't pull this before I did, but I was pretty quick. I wanted to note that Scott McLongstreet is going to retire. And I'm sure Marilyn will concur that this is one of these people you just hate to see go, but you bid them a fond farewell. Scott has been a wonderful custodian. He's a parent of two wonderful graduates who I believe went through the entire school system here at the Coast. And he's just a very good person. If you needed anything done at Baywood, any help with anything, Scott was the person to go to. So he's got some really, really big shoes to fill.
And that, it was the subject of discussion in my dining room today that he's retiring. I'm very happy for him. He also taught ceramics at Baywood. He just was, he began the composting program there. He's just been a terrific asset to that school, and I wish him well in retirement. I surely do.
So I will move approval of the certificated classified personnel items.
I'll second.
Anyone from the public? All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Moving on to, anyone have anything for advance agenda?
I have an interest in revisiting the academic eligibility for athletic participation or participation in athletics. I'd like us to look at it. We haven't looked at it. Not this board has looked at it in 4.5 years. I'm sure it goes back even much longer than that. And I'll have to bone up on the board policy on that, but I would like to revisit that.
Okay.
Do we have consensus?
I've got another version.
I'll support that. Okay. All right. Dr. Prater, so noted.
In a board report or Friday notes or?
Do you want it as an agenda item?
I think eventually as an agenda item. There might be some information that we need, and I don't feel a particular urgency on this. We can get it, you know, put it as back in May or whatever, June, if it'll fit somewhere in there conveniently.
Okay. I got noted. Okay.
Mr. Buckman?
Thank you. This past year, the legislature approved amendments to two of the Ed Code policies which would allow high schools to have voter registration on campus and have a student appointed or students appointed to be the voter registration coordinators. This would all be under the principal's or designee's direction. The principal would set up a location. It would take place in the last two full weeks of April and could take place in the last two full weeks of September. I don't know if it takes a board policy or not, but the students would coordinate it. They could coordinate debates. They could coordinate a straw vote. And, you know, we're hearing about less and less people voting, and I just think this would be great for civics and hopefully people voting in the next generation.
So would you be satisfied with some initial information coming forward in Friday notes?
Yeah, that's great.
I would support that.
That's a good idea.
Okay.
We'll provide that in the Friday update.
Okay, thank you.
Mrs. Schiffer, I'm interested in maybe a study, putting forward the study session on the A through G requirements, and don't know if that necessarily has to happen, you know, immediately, but I would like to see that further discussion happen.
Would you, and I have an interest in that as well, but I'm concerned about the timing because we have so much going on and nothing would happen. We couldn't do anything next year anyway, you know, in the fall anyways. Would you be satisfied if that were deferred for a few, maybe perhaps till after summer? I mean, we're coming towards the end of the school year, and then we have summer retreat.
Yes, even our retreat might be a good time, as long as we can start, you know, in earnest, perhaps, at the retreat time, that'd be great.
Okay.
And are you talking about having various outside people come and address us at that?
I think what we're talking about is the organization of what it would actually look like. Talking about that at the retreat, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, well, we usually have a retreat committee that, so everyone has input as to what they'd like to see occurred during the retreat. So I think it can be raised then, but I don't know whether, you know, oftentimes district office personnel is not around during summer retreat time. And but I'm wondering if Dr. Prater could maybe put forward a sort of a little timeline or what that would, and with Mr. Yeah. Robinette's help, yeah. based on his well-taken suggestions, what that a very skeletal look at, and then we could determine a timeline or something. Would that be acceptable?
Because
it does sound
idea. Thank you.
It's a big issue and might take some time to plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I envision a couple sessions in the fall that are designed in advance where we could invite certain representatives, experts, not just within the district, but also outside of the district to provide perspective. And then it would give us enough runway to make any necessary adjustments in time for planning for the following year. So that's kind of my thinking at this point. Okay. That's okay.
Is that all right with you?
It is. That's great. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So that was kind of my just one concern was is that we have enough run-up that we can get it. If there's any changes, get them in place for the following school year. So thank you.
All right. We're going to have some busy agendas. All right. Reports by board members. Anyone have anything to report? Mrs. Rogers.
I will be very brief. I went last Thursday night to the Common Core Math Night at Warren Bay High School. I saw Mrs. McGrath there. It was a good presentation. It gave rise to some parent questions about preparedness on the part of students, parents, and teachers for Common Core Mathematics at the high school level. And Mrs. McGrath encouraged parents to contact her directly with their specific questions. And I left before she did. I think she stayed after and spoke to some parents personally that night. So it was an interesting presentation. I was really glad that we were only asked to work collaboratively in the audience on one question because I really relied heavily on the other two parents in my group and identified myself only as Marilyn. So thank you for putting on the presentation.
Mr. Buckman?
I noticed in one of the newsletters, and this is will be embarrassing, I can't remember which school, but we like to give a shout-out to, I'm going to say this name wrong, I don't know, Kayleen Struble, and he was selected to compete in the state geography bee.
Yes.
Is that which?
Sam
Tompkins. There we go. We missed the report. And so he'll be at Fresno State on March 27th. All the best of luck.
Nice.
I thought he was I thought it was okay.
I just want to thank a few people that I was able to visit in the last week. Mrs. Storm at Monarch Grove, even though it was a minimum day, was able to quickly get me through several classes. And so I wanted to thank kindergarten teacher Evelyn Frame. She was basically hatching baby writers, and it was so much fun. I mean, they were just like scrambling around with their little stories that they had written, and in their own languages that were just a series of usually consonants that were together that they could read to us and tell us what these stories were. And they were inventive and absolute charming. And Nicole Butler. And Allison Engel, the special day class teachers, were very inviting to us. And one of the students was particularly excited about a volcano he had built that morning in an art class, which is being run by Jessica Irving as the artist in residence at Monarch Grove, which is being paid for by PTA funds.
Yes.
Thank you very much. And and also they are using PTA funds to have Elisa. Gies, I guess is her last name. Is that correct? Gies, G-I-E-S. She's the music teacher in residence that they've hired using their PTA funds as well. So that was very exciting stuff. And then today I got to go to Los Ranchos, where we started by
checking out a name here, but where we started with Lauren Grosso's first grade class, where a leprechaun had visited last night and done some mischief. And so the students, including little Matthew Prater, had brought to school and worked on in class some leprechaun traps. So they're gonna get that little mischief maker tonight. And then we moved on to second grade, where Cheryl Leszczynski was working on her second grade assessments. Got to see that at work. And then the piece de resistance was the wax museum in the gymnasium. Kelly Youngman and Chris Becker had their classes, their fourth grade classes. The kids were outfitted in these fabulous costumes, and they were posed as though they were in a wax museum, and they had little circles on their shoulder that when you touched them, they gave their speech about their characters, and they came to life, and then they went back into their suspended animation. So it was quite delightful. Yes, absolutely fun. And sorry to keep you so long, but I just wanted to share all that and say thank you to all those teachers and principals. Oh, Marley Schmidt for escorting me around all day today.
I'm sorry, Madam President. I've heard this geography B is from Laguna. It's a junior high. And then if I can, just art, he built a volcano in the art class. Mm-hmm. And if that isn't steam, yeah. I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's definitely
very cool.
All right. On that note, we will be back again. We have a study session on Friday. Yeah. Oh, I thought you wanted to say something. On Friday the 20th in B3 at the district office. And then our next regular board meeting on March 31st. Is that on my sheet? It says that March 31st is here again, but that's
All okay. The remaining meetings this year will be at J2.
Okay, great. Thank you for coming, and good night.